dismissive hand gesture and turned back to a bench. Someone else cursed and yelled, "You can't just keep us here!" Jenkins did not respond, but the truth on a technical level was that they could hold all patrons from the club until the investigators sorted out who was a potential witness and who might be a suspect. It was flimsy because common sense dictated that none of these people were suspects, but it was valid. "You okay?" Ballard asked. Jenkins turned around like he thought he was about to be jumped, then saw it was his partner. "Barely," he said. "I don't blame them. They're in for a long night. They're sending a jail bus for him. Wait till they see the bars on the windows. They'll really go apeshit then. Glad I won't be here to see it. Where are you going?" Ballard held up the evidence bag containing Cynthia Haddell's property. "I have to run by the hospital. They found more of her stuff. I'll be back in 20. We'll do the notification, and then it will be all over except for the paperwork. Next of kin will be a breeze compared to dealing with these animals. I think half of them are coming off highs. It's going to get uglier once they're all downtown. And not our problem. I'll be back." Ballard hadn't told her partner the real reason she was returning to the hospital, because she knew he would not approve of her true plan. She turned to go back to the car, but Jenkins stopped her. "Hey, partner."
"What?"
"You can lose the gloves now." He had noticed she still had crime scene gloves on. She held one hand up as if noticing the gloves for the first time.
"Right," she said. "As soon as I see a trash can."
At the car, Ballard kept the gloves on while she secured Cynthia Haddell's property in the same cardboard box that contained her tip apron. But first she removed Haddell's cell phone and slipped it into her pocket. It was 10 minutes back to Hollywood Presbyterian. She was banking on the fact that the shooting and mass casualties at the dancers had slowed the operations of the coroner's office, and that Haddell's body would still be waiting for pickup. She confirmed that was so when she got back to the ER and was led to a room where there were actually two covered bodies awaiting transport to the coroner. She asked the attendant to see if the doctor who had attempted to resuscitate Haddell was available. Ballard had kept her gloves on. She now pulled back the sheet on one of the bodies and saw the face of a young man who had wasted to no more than 100 pounds. She quickly recovered the face and went to the other gurney. She confirmed it was Haddell and then moved down the gurney to the victim's right hand. She pulled out the cell phone and pressed the pad of the dead woman's right thumb to the home button on the screen. The phone remained locked. Ballard tried the index finger, and that failed to open the phone as well. She moved around the gurney and went through the process again with the left thumb. This time the phone unlocked, and Ballard had access. She had to take one of her gloves off to manipulate the screen. She wasn't concerned with leaving fingerprints because the phone was property, not evidence, and likely would never be analyzed for latent prints. Having an iPhone herself, she knew the phone would relock soon if the screen didn't remain active. She went into the GPS app and scrolled through previous destinations. There was a Pasadena address, and Ballard clicked on it and set up a route there. It would keep the screen activated even as Ballard ignored the directions and went her own way. The phone would remain unlocked, and she'd have access to its contents after leaving the hospital. She checked the battery level and saw that it was at 60%, which would give her more than enough time to go through the phone. She muted the phone so the GPS app would not be audibly correcting her when she did not follow its directions to Pasadena. She was pulling the sheet back over the body when the door opened and one of the ER doctors looked in.
"I heard you asked for me," he said. "What are you doing in here?"
Ballard remembered his voice from the elevator right up to the OR.
"I needed to get a fingerprint," Ballard said, holding up the phone in further explanation. "But I wanted to ask you about another patient. I saw that you also worked on Gutierrez, the assault victim with the skull fracture. How is the patient?"
She was careful not to speak in terms of gender. The surgeon wasn't. He went with anatomy. "We did the surgery and he's still in recovery," he said. "We are inducing coma and it will be a waiting game. The sooner the swelling goes down, the better chance he has." Ballard nodded.
"Okay, thanks," she said. "I'll check back tomorrow. Did you happen to take any swabs for a rape kit?"
"Detective, our priority was keeping the victim alive," the doctor said. "That can all come later."
"Not really, but I understand."
The doctor was about to leave the doorway when Ballard pointed to the other gurney in the room.
"What's the story there?" she asked. "Cancer?"
"Everything," the doctor said. "Cancer, HIV, complete organ shutdown."
"Why is he going downtown?"
"It's a suicide. He pulled his tubes, disconnected the machines. I guess they have to be sure."
"Right. I need to go." The doctor disappeared from the doorway, and Ballard looked at the other gurney and thought about the man using his last ounces of strength to pull the tubes. She thought there was something heroic in that. In the car, she moved off the GPS screen on Cynthia Haddell's phone and opened the list of favorite contacts. The first one was labeled home, and Ballard checked the number. It was a 209 area code, and she expected that it was the number of the home where Haddell had grown up, in Modesto. There were four other favorite contacts, all listed by first name only. Jill, Kara, Leon, and John, all with LA area codes. Ballard figured she had enough to get to Haddell's parents if the number marked home didn't work. She next pulled up the texting app and checked that. There were two recent communications. One was to Kara. Cindy, guess who just scored a 50 on a round of martinis? Kara, you go, girl. Haddell responded with an emoji showing a happy face. The text before that began with a question from someone who wasn't on her favorites list. DP, how are you fixed? Cindy, I think I'm good. Maybe tomorrow? DP, let me know. There were no previous messages, indicating it was either a new acquaintance or the earlier exchanges had been deleted. There were several other text conversations on the app, but none of the others were active in the hours since Haddell had come to work. Ballard pegged Kara as most likely Haddell's best friend and DP as her drug supplier. She moved on to the email file and found the incoming messages were largely generic notifications and spam. Haddell apparently didn't do much in the way of emailing. Haddell's Twitter feed was as expected. She followed a number of entertainers, primarily in the music business, the dancer's own account, the LAPD's Hollywood Station feed regarding crime alerts, and the former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. The last app Ballard opened was the phone's photo archive. It said there were 662 photos. Ballard thumbed through the most recent and saw many photos of Haddell involved in activities with friends, working out, at the beach, and with cast and crew members on sets where she had found work as an actress. Ballard's own phone buzzed, and a photo of Jenkins came up on the screen. She answered the call with a question. The bus get there? Just left. Get me out of here. On my way. Ballard re-engaged the GPS route to Pasadena so the phone's screen would remain active and headed back to the dancers. After she picked up Jenkins, they drove to the La Brea address on Cynthia Haddell's driver's license. The first step of the notification process was to go to the victim's home to see if there might be a husband or other relative sharing the premises. It was a recently built apartment building, a half a block north of Melrose, in an area of shops and restaurants popular with the younger crowd. There were ramen noodle and build-your-own pizza restaurants fronting the first floor, with the building's entrance in the middle. Haddell's license listed her in Unit 4B. Ballard used one of the keys on the ring taken from the locker to gain entrance through a security door to the elevator lobby. She and Jenkins rode to the fourth floor and found 4B at the end of the hallway, leading to the back of the building. Ballard knocked twice, but no one answered. It did not mean there was no other occupant. Ballard knew from experience that someone could still be sleeping inside. She used the second key to open the door. By law, they should have had a search warrant, but both detectives knew they could cite exigent circumstances if a problem developed later. They had five people dead and no suspects and no motive. They needed to check on the safety of any possible roommates of their victim, no matter how peripheral to the case she might be. LAPD, anyone home? Ballard called out as they entered. Police, Jenkins added. We're coming in. Ballard kept her hand on her hip holster as she entered, but did not draw her gun. There was a single light on in the living room, which opened off a short entrance hallway. She visually checked a galley kitchen to the right and then moved toward another hallway leading to the back of the apartment. It led to a bathroom and a single bedroom. The doors to these rooms were open, and Ballard quickly hit light switches and scanned them. Clear, she called out when she confirmed there were no other occupants. She stepped back into the living room, where Jenkins was waiting. Looks like she lived alone, she said. Yep, Jenkins said. Doesn't help us any. Ballard started looking around, paying attention to the personal details of the small apartment. Knickknacks, photos on the shelves, a stack of bills left on the coffee table. Pretty nice place for a cocktail waitress, Jenkins said. The building is less than a year old. She was slinging dope at the club, Ballard said. I found her stash in her locker. There may be more here someplace. That explains a lot. Sorry, I forgot to tell you. Ballard moved into the kitchen, and saw a variety of photos on the refrigerator. Most of them were like the ones on Cynthia's phone, outings with friends. Several were of a trip to Hawaii that showed Hadle surfing on a training board and riding on a horseback trail through a volcano crater. Ballard recognized the outline of Haleakala in background and knew it was Maui. She had spent many years growing up on the island, and the shape of the volcano on the horizon had been part of her daily existence. She knew it the way people in L.A. knew the crooked line of the Hollywood sign. There was a photo partially obscured by newer additions to the refrigerator, but Ballard saw a woman of about 50 who shared the same jawline as Hadle. She carefully pulled it off and found that it showed Cynthia Hadle between a man and a woman at a Thanksgiving table, the cooked turkey on full display. It was most likely a shot of Hadle and her parents, the lines of heredity clear in both their faces. Jenkins came into the kitchen and looked at the photo in Ballard's hand. "You want to do it now?" he asked. "Get it over with?" "Might as well," she said. "Which way do you want to go with it?" "I'll just do it." Jenkins had been referring to the choice they had here. It is a harsh thing to learn by a telephone call that a loved one has been murdered. Ballard could have called the Modesto Police Department and asked them to make the notification in person. But going that way would remove Ballard from the process and she would lose the opportunity to get immediate information about the victim and any possible suspects. More than once in her career, when she had made next of kin notification, she had come up with credible leads to follow in the investigation. That seemed unlikely with Cynthia Hadle, since she was probably not at the center of motivation for the mass shooting. As Olivas had said, she was collateral damage, a fringe player in what had happened. So it was a valid question from Jenkins, but Ballard knew she would feel guilty later if she didn't make the call. She would feel like she had skirted a sacred responsibility of the homicide detective. Ballard pulled out Hadle's phone. The GPS program had kept the screen alive. She pulled up the contacts list to get the number for home and then called it from her own phone. It rang through to a voicemail greeting confirming it was the Hadle family home. Ballard left a message identifying herself and asking for a call back to her cell number, saying it was urgent. It was not unusual for people not to answer a blocked call in the middle of the night, but Ballard hoped that her message would bring a quick return call. She stepped over to the refrigerator and looked at the photos once again while waiting. She wondered about Cynthia growing up in Modesto, and then journeying south to the big city, where roles with partial nudity were okay and selling dope to Hollywood scenesters supplemented her income. After 5 minutes, there was no call back. Jenkins was pacing and Ballard knew he wanted to keep moving. "Call the cops up there?" he asked. "No, that could take all night," Ballard said. Then a phone started buzzing, but it wasn't Ballard's. Cynthia's phone showed an incoming call from the home number. Ballard guessed that her parents had gotten the message she just left and had chosen to call their daughter first to see if she was all right. "It's them," she said to Jenkins. She answered the phone. "This is Detective Ballard with the Los Angeles Police Department. Who am I speaking with?" "No, I called Cindy. What is going on there?" It was a woman's voice, already choked with desperation and fear. "Mrs. Hadle?" "Yes, who is this? Where is Cindy?" "Mrs. Hadle, is your husband with you? Just tell me, is she all right?" Ballard looked over at Jenkins. She hated this. "Mrs. Hadle," she said, "I'm very sorry to tell you that your daughter has been killed in a shooting at the club where she worked in Los Angeles." There was a loud scream over the line, followed by another, and then the sound of the phone clattering to the floor. "Mrs. Hadle?" Ballard turned towards Jenkins and covered the phone. "Call Modesto, see if they can send somebody," she said. "Where?" Jenkins asked. Then it hit Ballard. She didn't have an address to go with the phone number. She could now hear moaning and crying on the line, but it was distant from the phone, which was apparently still on the floor, somewhere in Modesto. Suddenly a gruff male voice was on the line. "Who is this?"
"Mr. Hadle? I'm a detective with the LAPD. Is your wife all right?"
"No, she's not all right. What's going on? Why do you have our daughter's phone? What happened?"
"She's been shot, Mr. Hadle. I am so sorry to do this by phone. Cynthia has been shot and killed at the club where she worked. I'm calling to..." "Oh, Jesus. Jesus Christ, is this some kind of joke? You don't do this to people, you hear me?"
"It's not a joke, sir. I am very sorry. Your daughter was hit by a bullet when someone started firing a weapon in the club. She fought hard. They got her to the hospital, but they were unable to save her. I am so sorry for your loss." The father didn't respond. Ballard could hear the mother's crying growing louder, and she knew that the husband had gone to his wife while still clutching the phone. They were now together. Ballard looked at the photo in her hand and pictured the couple holding on to each other as they grappled with the worst news in the world. She herself grappled with how far to push things at the moment, whether to intrude further into their agony with questions that might be meaningless in terms of the investigation. And then, "This is all because of that bastard boyfriend of hers," the father said. "He's the one who should be dead. He put her to work in there." Ballard made a decision. "Mr. Haddell, I need to ask you some questions," she said. "It could be important to the case." Chapter 6. Back at Hollywood Station, they divvied up the report writing. Jenkins took the Lantana burglary their shift had started with, and Ballard agreed to take the paper on Ramona Ramon and Cynthia Haddell. It was an uneven split, but it guaranteed that Jenkins would walk out the door at dawn and be home when his wife woke up. It was still called the paperwork, but it was all done digitally. Ballard went to work on Haddell first so that she could be sure to get the reports in before Olivas could ask for them. She also had plans to stall the Ramon case. She wanted to keep it for herself, and the longer she took doing the paperwork, the better chance she had of making that happen. The two partners did not have assigned desks in the detective bureau, but each had a favorite spot at which to work in the vast room that was usually left abandoned at night. These choices were primarily dictated by the comfort of the desk chair and the level of obsolescence of the computer terminal. Ballard preferred a desk in the burglary auto theft pod, while Jenkins posted himself at the opposite end of the room in the crimes against persons unit. There was a daytime detective who had brought in his own chair from the Relax the Back store, and Jenkins treasured it. It was locked by a long bike cable to the desk in the CAP's module, so that anchored him there. Ballard was a quick writer. She had a degree in journalism from the University of Hawaii, and while she had not lasted long as a reporter, the training and experience had given her skills that helped immeasurably with this side of police work. She reacted well to deadline pressure, and she could clearly conceptualize her crime reports and case summaries before writing them. She wrote short, clear sentences that gave momentum to the narrative of the investigation. This skill also paid dividends when Ballard was called into court to testify about her investigations. Juries liked her because she was a good storyteller. It was in a courtroom that the direction of Ballard's life had changed dramatically 15 years earlier. Her first job, out of the University of Hawaii, had been as one of a phalanx of crime reporters for the Los Angeles Times. She was assigned to a cubbyhole office in the Van Nuys courthouse, from which she covered criminal cases, as well as the six LAPD divisions that comprise the north end of the city. One particular case had caught her attention, the murder of a 14-year-old runaway who had been snatched off the beach one night in Venice. She had been taken to a drug house in Van Nuys, where she was repeatedly raped over several days, and then eventually strangled and dropped in a construction site trash hauler. The police made a case and took two men to trial for the murder. Ballard covered the preliminary hearing of the case against the accused. The lead detective testified about the investigation, and in doing so recounted the many tortures and indignities the victim endured before her eventual death. The detective started crying on the stand. It wasn't a show. There was no jury, just a judge to decide whether the case should go to trial. But the detective cried, and in that moment Ballard realized she didn't want to just write about crime and investigations anymore. The next day she applied to enter the LAPD Training Academy. She wanted to be a detective. It was 4:28 a.m. when Ballard began to write. Though Cynthia Haddell would need to be formally identified by the coroner's office, there was little doubt that she was the victim. Ballard put her name on the reports and listed her address on La Brea. She first wrote the death report that listed Haddell as the victim of a homicide by gunshot wound and included the basic details of the crime. She then wrote a chronology, a step-by-step accounting of the move she and Jenkins had made once they received the call from Lieutenant Monroe while at Hollywood Presbyterian. After the chrono was completed, she used it as an outline for her officer's statement, which was a more detailed summary of where the case had taken her and Jenkins through the night. After that, she moved on to documenting and filing the property she had collected from the hospital and the employee locker at the dancers. Before starting the process, she counted how many individual pieces she would be filing and then called the forensics lab and spoke to the duty officer, Winchester. "Have they started booking evidence from the four on the floor in Hollywood?" she asked. "I need a DR number." Every piece of booked evidence required its own division of records number. "That place is a mess," Winchester said.
They're still on scene and will probably be collecting all night and into the day. I don't expect they'll start booking evidence till noon. It's up to 5 now, by the way. 5 on the floor.
I know. Okay. I'll get my own numbers. Thanks, Winchester.
She got up and made her way over to Jenkins. I'm going to buy DRs out of the manual. You need any?
Yeah, get me one.
Be right back.
She took the rear hallway to the property room. She knew there would be no clerk on duty. There never was at this hour. The property room was left as empty as the detective bureau at night, but there was a division of records ledger on the counter, and it contained an up-to-date listing of DR numbers for booking property and evidence. Everything went to the FSD, the Forensic Sciences Division, for analysis as potential evidence. Since the lab could not provide a sequence of numbers for the RHD case, the property that Ballard and Jenkins had collected in their cases would be booked under Hollywood Division numbers instead, and shipped to the FSD for sorting. Ballard grabbed a scratch pad from the counter and wrote down a number from the ledger for Jenkins, and then a 7-number sequence for herself. The numbers all started with the year and the 06 designation for Hollywood Division. As she walked back down the empty hallway to the detective bureau, she heard a sudden echo of laughter from the watch office, which was in the opposite direction. Among the chortles, she identified the infectious sound of Lieutenant Monroe's laugh and smiled to herself. Cops were not humorless people. Even in the depths of the midnight shift on a night of massive violence, they could always find something to laugh about. She gave Jenkins his DR number, but didn't bother to ask how far along he was. She could see he was typing with 2 fingers and still on an incident report. He was slow to the point of frustration. Ballard usually volunteered to do all the paperwork, so she didn't have to wait for him to finish. Back at her borrowed desk, Ballard gloved up and went to work. It took her 30 minutes to process everything. This included the contents of the locker, the key the victim wore around her neck, and the money she had been carrying in her wallet and tip apron. It had to be counted out and documented. For her own protection, Ballard called Jenkins over so he could witness the money count, and she took cell phone photos of each evidence bag after sealing it. She took all of the plastic bags and placed them in one large brown paper sack that she marked with the DR number and sealed with red evidence tape. She then carried it back down the hallway to the property room and placed it in one of the lockers, where it would remain until someone working the case in RHD picked it up, or it was carried by courier to the lab for forensic analysis. When Ballard returned to the bureau, she saw that it was 6:11 on the clock, over the television screens. Her shift was supposed to end at 7 a.m., and overtime was only a slim possibility, because it was the middle of the month's deployment period, and money in the OT bucket was probably already gone. She didn't want overtime, however. She just wanted to push the Ramona Ramon case into her next shift. On the dancer's case, she still had summaries to write regarding her interviews with Haddle's parents and fellow waitresses. She knew it would take her to the end of her shift. She settled back into the workstation, opened up a new file on the computer screen, and was about to start the summary of her talk with Nelson Haddle when her cell buzzed, and she saw it was Lieutenant Monroe. LT.
Ballard, what's your location?
I'm in detectives, filing paper.
Heard you guys laughing it up a little while ago.
Oh yeah, we're having a ball up here.
I need you to take a statement.
From who?
I'm in the middle of this and still have the assault I haven't even touched yet.
A guy just walked in and said he was in the dancers when the shooting started. He said he has photos.
You sure?
It's a no-photo place.
He snuck a couple selfies.
Anything in them?
They're dark, but he's got something.
Looks like muzzle flash. Maybe they can enhance at the lab. That's why I need you to take this guy and see what he has and what he knows. He's sitting on a chair in the lobby. Grab him before he decides he doesn't want to wait any longer.
On my way.
But hey, LT, I'm out of here in 60. You signing any greenies tonight? I still haven't touched the assault, and now I have this witness.
She was referring to the green voucher cards a shift supervisor had to sign to authorize overtime.
I'll give you an hour, that's it, Monroe said. I can't blow the bank in one night. That should give you enough time to talk to this guy and finish up the paper on the dancers. The assault you can push till tomorrow. As long as the Vic is still kicking, I can't stall a homicide.
Last I checked, she came through surgery.
Okay, then come take this guy off my hands.
Roger that.
Ballard clicked off. She was pleased that she would not be turning the Ramona Ramon case over to the CAPS unit at the end of shift. That was more important to her than the overtime. On her way to the front lobby, she cruised by Jenkins' desk and saw that he was still typing with 2 fingers. She told him about the witness,
and added that they'd scored an hour of overtime, if he wanted it. He said no thanks. He had to get home. Chapter 7 The witness was a 23-year-old clubber named Xander Spates. Ballard took him back to the detective bureau and put him in a small interview room. He was a slightly built man wearing a dark blue hoodie over gray sweatpants. He kept his hands in his pockets of the hoodie, even when he sat down. "Xander, is that your real name?" Ballard began. "Short for Alexander," Spates said. "I like Xander better."
"Okay. What do you do for a living, Xander?"
"Oh, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I'm selling shoes at the moment."
"Where?"
"On Melrose, a place called Slick Kicks." Ballard was not taking notes. When they entered the room, she had adjusted the thermostat, which actually turned on the room's recording devices. It was wired for sight and sound.
"So you were in the dancers earlier this morning when the shooting started?" she asked.
"That's right," Spates said. "I was there."
"Were you alone?"
"No, I was with my boy Metro."
"What's Metro's real name?"
"I don't rightly know. He's just Metro to me."
"Where did you meet him?"
"He works at Kix. Met him there."
"So when did you get to the dancers?"
"Last night, around midnight."
"And you saw the shooting?"
"No, it was like behind me, two booths away, so I had my back to it. But just when it went down, I was taking selfies and I got the first shot. It's crazy."
"Show me."
Spates took his iPhone out of his hoodie's pocket and opened up the photo archive. "I took three on live photos," he said. "You can swipe through." He put the phone down on the table between them and slid it to Ballard. She looked at the photo on the screen. Front and center was Spates himself, but over his right shoulder, Ballard could see the dark outlines of the other crowded booths. No one was identifiable. It would be up to the video unit in the lab to try to enhance.
"Keep going," Spates urged. "I got the shot."
The second photo Ballard swiped to was similar to the first, but the third grabbed her interest. The camera had captured a flash of light in the second booth over Spates' shoulder. He had indeed taken the photo just as the shooting started. He got the muzzle flash. Because the phone's camera had the live photos feature, it captured a second of action leading to the actual freeze frame. Ballard tapped it several times to replay and saw that within the single second, she could see the killer's arm raise the weapon and then the shot. Ballard used her fingers to expand the photo and center the screen on the flash of light. It was very blurry, but she could tell that the shooter's back was to the camera. She could see the indistinct lines of the back of his head and his right shoulder. His right arm was up, holding the weapon, and pointing it directly across the booth at a man who would moments later slump to his left and hang out of the booth. The victim's face was blurred as he recoiled at the sight of the weapon.
"I bet they can enhance that," Spates said. "Is there a reward or something?"
Ballard looked over the top of the phone at Spates, as his motives for coming into the station became clear.
"A reward?" she asked.
"Yeah, you know, like for helping solve the case," Spates said. "I don't know anything about a reward."
"Well, there should be. I was in danger."
"We'll have to see about that later. Tell me what happened when the shooting started. What did you do?"
"Me and Metro got under the table and hid out," Spates said. "Then the shooter ran by our table and shot some more people. We waited until he was gone and then we got the fuck out of there."
Ballard texted the photo showing the muzzle flash to her own phone.
"Mr. Spates, do you know where Metro lives?" she asked.
"Nah, I don't know," Spates said. "This was the first time we hung out and we both had our own wheels."
"Okay, we'll find him through Slick Kicks if we need to."
"He'll be there."
"And I'm sorry, but we're gonna have to keep your phone for a while."
"Aw, fuck, man, you just texted the photo to yourself, right? You got the photo."
He pointed to his phone.
"I understand," Ballard said. "But your phone has the live photos feature, and the lab may be able to pull stills from each moment of the shot you took. It looks like the gun is clearer before the recoil from the shot. It could be very useful, and I think they'll want the camera it was taken on, not just a copy of the photo. They need to look at your phone."
"Fuck me. How long?"
"I'm not sure, but hopefully just a few days." She knew that was a lie. He would probably never get the phone back, as it would be held as evidence. But she decided to leave that for someone in RHD to explain.
"What do I use for a phone in the meantime?" Spates demanded.
"Maybe you can borrow one or get a burner," Ballard offered.
"Fuck me.
I want you to stay here while I print a property received receipt."
"God damn. There better be a reward or something."
Ballard stood up.
I'll look into that, and I'll be back as soon as I print the receipt.
Ballard left the room with the phone and walked over to Jenkins, who was still typing. She held the phone up in front of him and tapped the photo, setting the one-second video into motion.
"Holy shit," Jenkins said.
"Yeah," Ballard said. "1,000,000-to-1 shot."
"Can you see anybody?"
"Not the shooter. His back's to the camera. But I think the lab might be able to identify the gun off it."
"Nice. You tell Olivas?"
"About to."
Back at her borrowed workstation, she realized she had left her rover in the car and did not have a phone contact for Lieutenant Olivas. His number had been blocked when he called her earlier. She could send him an email, but that wasn't expedient. Opening her phone, she scrolled through the contacts until she came to the name Ken Chastain. She had kept his number, even after he betrayed their partnership and she had been transferred out of RHD. She sent him a text.
"Tell Olivas? Walk-in, witness, at 6, was in nearby booth. Has cell photo of shooting. Lab may be able to enhance."
After sending it, she printed a property receipt for Spates. She went to grab it out of the printer and then dropped by the break room to get a coffee. She allowed herself one cup a night, and it was time. It would give her enough of a boost to finish the shift, and then an hour's paddle on the bay. After that, she would crash and recuperate. On her way, she called across the room to Jenkins, but he passed on the caffeine. In the break room, she was putting a coffee pot into the brewer when her phone dinged with a return text from Chastain.
"Who's this?"
He had not even kept her number in his phone. She answered with her old radio designation from RHD, King 65, and also forwarded the muzzle flash photo. If Chastain had a newer iPhone, he would be able to see the split-second video image and realize its value. By the time she got back to her workstation, her phone was buzzing with a blocked call. She expected it to be Chastain, but it was Olivas.
"Detective, do you still have the witness there?"
"Yes, he's in the interview room, probably wondering where I've been for 20 minutes.
"Hold him. Chastain is en route and will be there in 5 minutes. Does he have any other photos?"
"Not like the one I sent Chastain."
"And you have the phone?"
"On my desk and about to get the guy to sign a receipt."
"Good. Chastain will be taking the phone too."
"Got it.
Have you filed your reports, detective?"
"About to. I booked the victim's property here and just have a couple interview summaries to finish."
"Finish and file, detective."
Again, Olivas disconnected before she could respond. She looked up and saw that Jenkins had sauntered over.
"What's happening?"
"Chastain is coming for the phone and the witness. We're still out of it."
"Good. I'm almost done with the burglary."
He started to turn back toward his corner of the room.
"Don't you ever want to see something through?" Ballard asked.
Jenkins didn't turn around.
"Not anymore," he said.
He kept going. Ballard then heard pounding on the door of the interview room.
Xander Spates had just found out he had been locked in.
Ballard went to the room with the receipt and opened the door.
"What the fuck? You locked me in here like I'm a prisoner or something."
"You're not a prisoner, Mr. Spates. It's department policy. We can't have civilians roaming around the station."
"Well, what's going on? Where's my phone?"
"I have your phone, and another detective is coming to talk to you. It's his case, and he thinks you may be quite an important witness. In fact, you should talk to him about the reward. I'm sure he can help with that."
"Really?"
"Yes, really.
So I need you to step back and have a seat and calm down. Here's the receipt for your phone. I need you to sign one copy and keep the second. Detective Chastain should be here in a few minutes."
She pointed to a seat at the table and started moving back from the door. He sat down and signed the receipt with a pen she handed him. She then took the signed copy and retreated, closing the door and locking it again. Chastain got there 5 minutes later, walking in from the back hallway. He came directly to Ballard at her workstation.
"Where's my witness?"
Room 2. "His name is Xander Spates, and here's the phone." She had already put it in a clear plastic evidence bag. She held it up to him and he took it.
"Okay, I'm going to take him."
"Good luck."
He turned and headed toward the interview room.
Ballard stopped him.
"Oh, I also booked the waitress's property if you want it," she said. "When I talked to the parents a little while ago, her father said her boyfriend was a drug pimp. Made her sell in the club."
Chastain nodded.
"Interesting, but probably not related," he said.
"I didn't think so," Ballard said.
"But the stuff's there in property. If you don't take it, it'll get sent down with the next courier pickup."
Chastain did another 180 to head toward the interview room. but then once again walk back to her. How's Lola doing?
She's good.
Good.
Then nothing.
But Chastain didn't move.
Ballard finally looked up at him.
Something else? She asked.
Yeah, he said. You know, Renee, I'm really sorry about how everything worked out back then.
Ballard looked at him for a moment before answering.
It took you 2 years to say that? She finally said.
He shrugged.
I guess so, yeah.
You're totally forgetting something you told me back then.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about when you told me to back off the complaint. About how you said Olivas was going through a bad divorce and losing half his pension and not acting right and all that bullshit. As if it made what he did to me okay.
I don't understand what this has to do with...
You didn't even keep my number in your phone, Kenny. You washed your hands of the whole thing. You're not sorry about anything. You saw an opportunity back then and you took it. You had to throw me under the bus, but you didn't hesitate.
No, you're wrong.
No, I'm right. If anything, you feel guilty, not sorry. She stood up at her desk to get on equal footing with him. Why the hell did I ever think you would do the right thing and back your own partner, she said. I was stupid to trust you, and here I am. But you know what? I'd rather be working the late show with Jenkins than be with you at RHD. At least I know what to expect from him.
Chastain stared at her for a moment, color rising in his cheeks. Ballard remembered that he had an easy tell when people got to him, and she had gotten to him. Next came the awkward smile and the mouth wipe. She had hit the trifecta.
Okay, then, he finally said. Thanks for the witness.
He turned toward the interview room.
Anytime, Ballard called after him.
She grabbed the empty coffee cup off the desk and headed toward the squad room exit. She didn't want to be anywhere near Chastain. Chapter 8. The hour of overtime she had worked pushed Ballard into the heavy morning traffic, moving west toward the beaches. The army of service industry workers advanced from the east side to their minimum wage and underjobs in hotels, restaurants, and neighborhoods where they could not afford to live. It took Ballard almost an hour to get to Venice. Her first stop was to pick up Lola from the overnight caretaker, and then they headed to the beach. The only good thing about the slog across the city was that the marine layer was already burning off by the time she got to the sand, and she could see that the bay was cobalt blue and as flat as glass. She parked in one of the lots by the north end of the boardwalk and went to the back of her van. She let Lola out, grabbed one of her tennis balls out of the basket by the wheel well, and threw it across the empty parking lot. The dog took off after it and had it in her mouth in 3 seconds. She dutifully brought it back to Ballard, who threw it a few more times before putting it back in the basket. The dog whined at having such a short game.
We'll play later, Ballard promised.
She wanted to get out on the water before the wind kicked up. Ballard's van was a white Ford Transit Connect that she'd bought used from a window washer who was retiring and closing his business. It had 80,000 miles on it, but the previous owner had taken good care of it. Ballard kept the ladder racks on the roof for carrying her board, and as in the work car she shared with Jenkins, the rear storage area of the van was compartmentalized with cardboard boxes. Before exiting Hollywood Station, Ballard had changed into faded jeans and a red hoodie over a tank suit, leaving her work suit in a locker. She now stripped down to the tank and put the other clothes in a backpack, along with underwear, socks, and a pair of New Balance trainers. She next grabbed one of the wetsuits, off a hanger hooked on the inside wall of the van. She squeezed into it and pulled the rear zipper up her back with a short tether. She took a big beach towel out of one of the boxes and stuffed that into the backpack last. She clipped her tent bag to the side of the backpack and put it on over both shoulders. Lastly, she grabbed a multigrain and chocolate energy bar out of an insulated cooler she kept food in and was ready. She closed and locked the van, then pulled her board off the roof racks. It was an 8-foot-1 world board with a paddle attached to clips on the deck. It was a bear to bring down off the van's roof, and she was careful not to bounce the tail fin on the asphalt. She put her fingers into the center grip hole and carried the board under her right arm while using her left to feed herself. She trudged toward the water barefoot, and walking gingerly until she was off the parking lot and into the sand. Lola followed dutifully. She set up the tent 25 yards off the water's edge. Its assembly was an easy 5-minute routine. She placed her backpack inside to stabilize the tent against any wind and then zipped the entrance closed. She buried the key to the van in the sand by the front right corner of the tent
and then pointed at the spot until the dog took her place there.
"Keep watch," she said.
The dog bowed her head once. Ballard hefted the 30-pound board again and carried it to the water. She wrapped the leash around her right ankle and secured it with the Velcro strap, then pushed the board out ahead of her. Ballard only weighed 125 pounds and could step up onto the board without tipping the balance. She powered through 4 right-hand strokes with the paddle to get out past the low rollers, and then at last was smoothly gliding through what was left of the morning mist. She looked back once at her dog. Even though she knew she didn't have to, Lola sat at attention at the right front corner of the tent. She would do so until Ballard got back. Ballard had started a paddling routine soon after her transfer to the Late Show. She had grown up surfing on the West Maui beaches, between Wailea and Lahaina, and had traveled to surf with her father in Fiji, Australia, and elsewhere. But she left surfing behind when she moved to the 48 to pursue a career in law enforcement. Then one night, she and Jenkins were called to a residential burglary in the Bird Streets in the hills off Doheny Drive. A couple had come home from dinner at Spago and found the door of their $5 million home ajar and the interior ransacked. Patrol officers arrived first, and then Ballard and Jenkins were called out because the victims were deemed HVC, high-value constituents, by the station commander. He wanted detectives to roll along with a crime scene team right away. Shortly after arriving, Jenkins was supervising the crime scene techs at the point of entry, while Ballard surveyed the home with the lady of the house, trying to determine exactly what had been taken. In the master bedroom, they entered a massive walk-in closet. It was hidden behind floor-to-ceiling mirrors, and not seen when the first patrol officers to arrive had checked the house. On the floor of the closet, a fur coat was spread open. Piled in the center of the coat's silk lining were a mound of jewelry and 3 pairs of high-heeled shoes with red soles that Ballard knew cost more than $1,000 apiece. At that moment, Ballard realized that the burglar might still be in the home. At that exact moment, the intruder jumped from behind a row of clothes on hangers and tackled her to the ground. The lady of the house backed up against a mirrored wall in the closet and stood there frozen and mute as Ballard struggled with a man who had almost 100 pounds on her. The intruder grabbed one of the red-soled shoes and was attempting to drive the spiked heel into Ballard's eye. She held his arm back but knew he was too strong to hold off for long. She managed to call out for Jenkins as a spike came closer to her face. She turned her face at the last moment, and the spike dragged across her cheek, drawing a line of blood. The intruder pulled it back to start another go at her eye, when he was suddenly hit from behind by Jenkins, wielding a small bronze sculpture he'd picked up on his way through the bedroom. Ballard's attacker collapsed unconscious on top of her, the sculpture broken too. The intruder turned out to be the couple's schizophrenic son, who had disappeared from the home years earlier and was presumed to be living on the streets in Santa Monica. Ballard ended up with 4 butterfly stitches applied to her cheek at Cedars-Sinai, and Jenkins and the department got sued by the couple and their son for using excessive force and for damaging an expensive work of art. The city settled the lawsuit for $250,000, and Ballard took up paddleboarding to increase her upper body strength and clear her mind of the memory of the spiked heel inching toward her eye. The sky turned gray as the sun slipped behind the clouds, and the water turned a dark impenetrable blue. Ballard liked turning the paddle blade sideways and watching it slice a thin line down through the water until the white tip on it disappeared in darkness. She would then turn the blade and power through a full stroke, the board and paddle making barely a mark on the surface as she moved. She called it stealth paddling. She made a wide loop that took her at least 300 yards offshore. She checked her tent every few minutes and saw no one approaching or disturbing it or the dog. Even from a distance, she could identify the lifeguard in the station 75 yards down the beach. Aaron Hayes was one of her favorites. He was her backup to Lola. She knew he would be watching over her things and would probably visit her later. Her mind wandered as she worked, and she thought of the confrontation earlier with Chastain in the detective bureau. She wasn't happy with herself. She had waited 2 years to say what she had to say to him, but it had been the wrong time and place. Ballard had been too consumed with his betrayal to remember what was important in the present, the murder of 5 people, including Cynthia Hattle. She turned the board and paddled further out. She felt guilty. It didn't matter that Hattle was a peripheral victim. Ballard felt that she had let her down by putting her own agenda with Chastain first. It went to the sacred bond that existed between homicide victims and the detectives who speak for them. It wasn't Ballard's case, but Hattle was her victim, and the bond was there.
Ballard bent her knees sharply and took several deep digging strokes as she tried to move on from the Chastain loop she kept playing in her head. She tried to think about Ramona Ramon instead, and about Officer Taylor saying that she had been at the Upside Down House. Ballard wondered what that meant, and it worked on her, becoming the new loop that played in her head. After an hour on the water, Ballard had a layer of sweat building between her skin and the wetsuit. It kept her warm, but she could feel her muscles tightening. Her shoulders, thighs, and hamstrings ached, and it felt like the point of a pencil had been pushed into a spot between her shoulder blades. She turned back towards shore and finished with a sprint of deep, long pulls on the paddle. She came out of the water so thoroughly exhausted that she tore the leash off her ankle and dragged the tail of the board in the sand all the way back to the tent. Even as she did it, she knew she was violating the first thing her father ever taught her. Don't drag the board. Bad for the glass. Lola had not moved from her position as sentry at the front of the tent. Good girl, Lola, Ballard said. Good girl. She put the board down next to the tent and patted her dog. She unzipped the entrance and grabbed a treat for Lola, out of a pocket on the inside flap. She also pulled her backpack out. After feeding the dog the treat, she told her to stay, and walked across the sand to the row of public showers behind the paddle tennis courts. She stripped off the wetsuit and showered in her bathing suit, keeping a wary eye out for homeless men who had started to wake and move about the nearby boardwalk. Her late start put her on their schedule. She was usually finished paddling and showering before any life even stirred on the boardwalk. When she was sure she had all the salt out of her hair, she cut the water and dried off the large beach towel she removed from the backpack. She pulled the straps of her bathing suit down over her shoulders, then wrapped the towel around her body from armpits to knees. She dropped the wet bathing suit to the concrete and brought her underwear up her legs under the towel. She had been dressing on beaches this way ever since she used to surf before classes at Lahaina Luna High School. By the time she dropped the towel, she was dressed again in her jeans and hoodie. Using the towel to dry her hair, she went back across the sand to the tent, patted Lola on the head again, and crawled into the nylon shelter. Easy, girl, she said. Lola dropped down into a resting pose but maintained her spot on top of where the key was buried. Ballard got another dog treat out of the pocket on the tent flap and tossed it to her. The dog ripped it out of the air with her teeth and then quickly returned to her stoic pose. Ballard smiled. She had bought Lola off a homeless man on the boardwalk 2 years earlier. The animal was emaciated and chained to a shopping cart. She had open wounds that looked like they had come from fighting other dogs. Ballard had simply wanted to rescue her, but a bond quickly formed, and the dog stayed with her. They took training classes together, and soon it seemed as though the dog had a sense that Renee had saved her. She was unfailingly loyal to Ballard, and Ballard felt the same way. Ready to sleep, Ballard pulled the zipper on the tent flap down. It was 11 a.m. Normally, she would sleep until it was almost sunset, but this time, Ballard set her phone to wake her up at 2 p.m. She had plans for the day before starting her official shift at 11. She had hoped for 3 hours of sleep but barely got two. Shortly after 1 o'clock, she was awakened by the low growl Lola projected when someone invaded her no-fly zone. Ballard opened her eyes but didn't move. Come on, Lola, you don't love me anymore. Still coming out of interrupted sleep, Ballard recognized the voice. It was Aaron Hayes. Lola, she said. It's okay. What's up, Aaron? I was sleeping. Sorry. You want some company in there? I got my lunch break. Not today, Aaron. I gotta get up soon and go in. Okay. Sorry I woke you up. By the way, you look good out there today. Like you were walking on water. Good long strokes. Tired myself out, but thanks, Aaron. Good night. Yeah, good night. She heard him chuckle as he walked away in the sand. Good girl, Lola, she said. Ballard rolled onto her back and looked up at the roof of the tent. The sun was high and so bright she could see it through the nylon. She closed her eyes and tried to remember if she had been dreaming before Aaron woke her. She couldn't remember anything but thought there was something there in the gray tendrils of her sleep. There had been a dream. She just couldn't remember what it was. She tried to retrieve it, to slip back in, but she knew that a standard sleep cycle was about 90 minutes. To go back to sleep and get a full cycle would take longer than she had. Her alarm was going off in less than an hour, and she wanted to stick to her plan of getting up and going into work on finding out who had used brass knuckles to assault Ramona Ramon in the Upside Down House, and then left her for dead in a Hollywood parking lot. She got out of the tent,
packed and folded it up, and then returned to the van. She restowed everything and placed the wetsuit on its hanger. The board was harder to put back on the roof racks than it had been to take down. Ballard was 5'7" and had to open the side doors and stand on the sill while she secured the straps. The second strap cut across the One World logo on the underside of the board. It showed the black silhouette of a surfer riding the nose, his hands and arms up over his head and thrown back like he was flying down the steep face of a monster wave. It always reminded Ballard of her father and his last wave, the one that took him and left her running up and down the beach, unsure of what to do or where to go, and howling helplessly at the open sea. She and Lola walked down the boardwalk to the Poke Poke window, where Ballard ordered the Aloha bowl with added seaweed for her and a teriyaki beef and rice bowl for the dog. Lola drank from the dog bowl under the window as they waited, and the man behind the counter handed Ballard a treat for Lola as well. After lunch, he took the dog back out to the sand and threw a ball a few more times. But Ballard's mind wasn't on it. The whole time she was thinking about work. She was officially off the dancer's case but couldn't help thinking about Cynthia Haddell. Ballard had the name and digits of the distributor who, according to her parents, had put her into the club to deal drugs. If RHD wasn't interested, then the buy bus team at Hollywood Division would take the tip and do something with it. She made a mental note to drop by the unit when she got back to the station. From the beach, Ballard drove back to the critter sitter to drop off Lola. She apologized to the dog for the short day, but promised to make it up to her. Lola bowed her head once, letting Ballard off the hook. On the way into Hollywood, Ballard checked the Los Angeles Times feed on her phone every time she caught a red light. It had been barely 12 hours since the shooting at the dancers, so the newspaper had scant reporting on it. Ballard was still ahead of the media curve, with the limited information she had gathered on her shift. The Times did say, however, that there were no arrests or suspects in the mass killing as of the latest update from the LAPD. The story went out of its way to reassure readers that the police were not looking at this as a possible terrorist attack, like those seen in other nightclubs domestically and around the world. Ballard was disappointed that the newspaper had not by now gotten the names of the three men shot to death in the booth. That was the angle she was wondering about. Who were they? What went wrong in that booth? After checking the Times feed, she also checked her email and saw nothing on return from Lieutenant Olivas about the report she had submitted. Apparently her paper had been accepted, if not gone unnoticed. Either way, the timestamps on the email she had sent would protect her from any complaint from Olivas about her failing to file her reports in a timely fashion. Using the van's Bluetooth connection, Ballard called Hollywood Presbyterian and asked for the duty nurse in the surgical intensive care unit. A woman who called herself Nurse Randall answered, and Ballard identified herself right down to her serial number. An assault victim named Ramona Ramon was brought in last night. I was the responding detective. She underwent brain surgery, and I'm checking on her status. Ballard was put on hold, and when Randall came back, she said there was no patient in the hospital named Ramona Ramon, and that Ballard must be mistaken. You're right, Ballard said. Can you check a different name? Ramon Gutierrez. I forgot that's the victim's actual name. Randall put her on hold again, but this time came back more quickly. Yes, he's here, and he's stable after surgery, she said. Do you know if he's conscious yet? Ballard asked. That's information you will need to get from the patient's attending physician. Is that physician available? Not at this time. He's on his rounds. Nurse Randall, I am investigating this crime and trying to find out who attacked Mr. Gutierrez. If the victim is conscious, I need to drop what I'm doing and come talk to him. If he's not, then I need to proceed with the investigation. There is a very dangerous individual out there responsible for this. Are you sure you can't help me by answering that simple question? Has he regained consciousness? There was a long pause, as Randall decided whether to break the rules. No, he hasn't. He is still in an induced coma. Thank you. Can you also tell me? Have any family members or friends come in to check on her? Him, I mean? There is nothing here about that. No family listed. Friends would not be allowed to visit an ICU. Thank you, Nurse Randall. Ballard disconnected. She decided she was going straight into Hollywood Station. Chapter 9. Ballard kept all her work suits in her locker at the station and dressed for her shifts after arriving each night. She had four different suits that followed the same cut and style, but differed in color and pattern. She dry-cleaned them two at a time so that she always had a suit and a backup available. After arriving nearly 8 hours early for her shift, Ballard changed into the gray suit that was her favorite. She accompanied it with a white blouse. She kept four white blouses and one navy in her locker as well. It was Friday, and that meant Ballard was scheduled to work solo. She and Jenkins had to cover 7 shifts a week, so Ballard took Tuesday to Saturday, and Jenkins covered Sunday to Thursday, giving them 3 overlap days. When they took vacation time, their slots usually went unfilled. If a detective in the division was needed during the early morning hours, then someone had to be called in from home. Working solo suited Ballard because she didn't have to run decisions by her partner. On this day, if he had known what Ballard's plan was, Jenkins would have put the kibosh on it. But because it was Friday, they would not be working together again until the following Tuesday, and she was clear to make her own moves. After suiting up, Ballard checked herself in the mirror over the locker room sinks. She combed her sun-streaked hair with her fingers. That was all she usually had to do. Constant immersion in salt water and exposure to the sun over years had left her with broken, flyaway hair that she kept no longer than chin length out of necessity. It went well with her tan and gave off a slightly butch look that reduced advances from other officers. Olivas had been the exception. Ballard squeezed some Visine drops into her eyes, which were red from the salt water. After that, she was good to go. She went into the break room to brew a double shot espresso on the Keurig. She would be operating now and through the night on less than 3 hours of sleep. She needed to start stacking caffeine. She kept her eye on the wall clock because she wanted to time her arrival in the detective bureau at shortly before 4 p.m., when she knew the lead detective in the CAPS unit would also be watching the clock, getting ready to split for the weekend. She had at least 15 minutes to kill, so she went up to the offices of the bi-bus team next to the vice unit. Major Narcotics was located downtown, but each division operated its own street-level drug squad that moved nimbly and was responsive to citizen complaints about drug-dealing hotspots. Ballard had limited connections to the officers assigned to the unit, so she went in cold-calling. The duty sergeant took the information she had on Cynthia Haddell's boyfriend-slash-drug pimp. The name Cynthia's father had given Ballard was someone the sergeant said was already on the radar as a small-time dealer who worked the Hollywood club scene. What made Ballard feel bad was that he said that the guy had a girlfriend working and selling for him in just about every hot spot in the division. She left the office, wondering if Haddell had known that or had believed she was the only one. At 3:50 p.m., Ballard entered the detective bureau and looked for a spot to use as a workbase. She saw that the desk she had used the night before was still empty, and she thought maybe the detective who owned it had left early or was on a 4:10 schedule and off Fridays. As she took the spot, she scanned the bureau and her eyes settled on the 4-desk pod that comprised the CAPS unit. She saw all the desks were empty except for Maxine Rowlands, the unit lead. It looked like she was packing her briefcase for the weekend. Ballard sauntered over, timing it perfectly. "Hey, Max," she said. "Renee," Roland responded. "You're early. You have court?" "No, I came early to clean up some work. I owe you a case from last night, but the dancers thing blew up and everything got pushed sideways." "I get it. What's the case?" "An abduction? An assault? The victim is a transgender biological male, found circling the drain in a parking lot on the Santa Monica Stroll. She's in a coma at Hollywood Press."
"Shit."
Roland just saw her exit to the weekend blocked. And that was what Ballard was counting on. "Was there a sexual assault?" Roland asked. Ballard could tell what she was thinking. Push this on to the sexual assault unit. "Most likely, but the victim lost consciousness before being interviewed," she said. "Shit," Roland said again. "Look, I just came in to start the paper on it. I was also thinking I'd have time before my shift to make some calls. Why don't you get out of here and let me run with it? I'm on tomorrow, too. So I could take it through the weekend and get back with you next week." "You sure? If it's a bad beat, I don't want to part-time it." "I won't. I'll work it. I haven't been able to follow up on anything off the Late Show in a long while. There are some leads here. You recall anything lately with Brass Knuckles?" Roland thought for a moment and then shook her head. "Brass Knuckles? No. What about an abduction off the Stroll? She was taken somewhere and bound, then taken back. Could have been a couple days." "It's not ringing any bells, but you need to go up to talk to Vice." I know, it was my next stop if you let me run with it. What about the upside-down house? That mean anything to you?
How do you mean?
She said it to the patrol.